A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corn. For those of us who read the Bible, when we come across words, we tend to automatically think that our understanding of those words maps onto what those words meant during that time. One example I would give is honey. If we read in a biblical portion that mentions honey in some context, we tend to assume bee honey because it's the most familiar and popular honey in the West. But if I recall correctly, what I read about, and there's been some interesting books written about the daily diet in the biblical period in ancient Israel, much more likely, and I think agreed, that I was referring to date honey, the food known as silan in modern Hebrew. And that's still very popular and prevalent throughout the Middle East. And so it just changes your conception when you build a mental model of reading a part of the Torah and honey is mentioned. You think about a sticky, dark, brown fluid as opposed to bee honey. Another example, and one that I'd like to talk about today, is bread, which actually features extensively in biblical metaphor and often used as a metaphor for daily life. I went through a phase of interest in this broader question of what did people actually eat in the Bible when I was, strangely enough, in my graduate years, living in London, where there was just this enormous scene of ethnic markets, and any ingredient that you wanted you could find somewhere, including goat meat, which we talked about in another episode. But one of the endeavors that I went upon was making barley bread. When we hear about bread and think about what bread means to us today, we tend again to think about things like maybe baguettes or in the Middle East, pita breads that are usually made from wheat or for those a couple of other grains for those who are maybe on restricted diets. But for a significant chunk of the narrative described in the events of the Bible, the predominant grain was barley, and this includes the temple era. Barley was what was prevalent and readily available, and wheat was more consumed in smaller quantities for the nobility, which is interesting to think about. I recall trying to find recipes that would recreate what bread would have actually tasted like and looked like in the early biblical period, and it was quite the endeavor. Even here in Israel today, it's not that easy to find pure barley flour, and off the shelf sometimes you'll see companies making barley bread as a novelty, but it's often actually a 70% barley bread because modern consumers just aren't expecting what pure barley bread actually looks like. Of course, being dedicated to this mission, I tracked down pure barley flour and found a recipe for barley bread that was pretty credible. And to cut to the chase, because of the lower gluten content, you end up with something that is called bread, but which doesn't really bear much resemblance to what we know of as bread today. It's very, very dense. It's very satiating. I recall it actually being very nice. And it kind of forms these flat circular loaves. And again, it's one of those things that if you can cook it in your oven in an hour, if you can source the recipe and the flour. And once you have it, it will change how you think about whenever you read bread in the Bible. You won't think about people cutting into a beautiful, fluffy sourdough so much as imagine this kind of robust, satiating stuff being handed out. And actually, I think, makes bread as being a staple of daily nutrition actually more understandable, the physical constitution of the product. I'd love to talk, Herman and Corn, today's episode about the history of barley, especially its use and its enjoyment during the biblical period, how it came to be supplanted by wheat, And barley bread continues these days. I remember looking for recipes, not, you know, historical recreation recipes, but actual recipes that are still used. Found a couple from Scotland and a couple from Estonia, if I recall correctly. You will see some cultures that still enjoy pure barley bread, unadulterated barley bread. If one were to make it today to get that kind of authentic biblical recreation experience, any recipe you can recommend? Herman and Corin, let's talk about the history of barley wheat succession in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been on a bit of a biblical food deep dive, and he landed on barley. Specifically, the history of barley bread in the biblical period, how wheat eventually took over, and whether there's a way to make authentic barley bread today. And he makes this great point up front. When we read words like bread in ancient texts, we just slot in our modern image, baguette, sourdough, pita. But what they were actually eating was a completely different thing.
It's not just a culinary detail. Bread in the Hebrew Bible is the metaphor. By the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. Man does not live by bread alone, the showbread in the temple. If you're picturing a nice artisan loaf with a crosshatch crust, you've got the wrong mental furniture entirely.
I'm keeping that.
It's yours. But here's the thing that grabbed me. Barley wasn't just one grain among many. For a huge stretch of the biblical narrative, it was the grain, the thing that kept civilization running. Wheat was the luxury upgrade.
Walk me through the timeline. When we say biblical period, we're covering a lot of ground. Where does barley really dominate?
We should be precise here. The Hebrew Bible spans roughly from the 2nd millennium BCE through the Persian period, call it the 5th century BCE, and across that entire arc, barley is the workhorse. Archaeological evidence from sites all over Israel and Judah, places like Tel Rehov, Megiddo, Lachish, consistently shows barley as the dominant cereal in storage pits and household contexts. Wheat is present, but in much smaller quantities.
The reason is climate, right? Barley's tougher.
Barley is vastly more drought-tolerant than wheat. It can handle poorer soils, it matures faster, it needs less water. In the marginal farming zones of the Judean Hill Country, which is where a lot of the biblical story unfolds, barley was the reliable crop. Wheat was what you grew in the good years, in the better-watered valleys. There's a reason the Book of Ruth opens with Naomi's family leaving Bethlehem, which literally means house of bread, during a famine, and the harvest happening around them is the barley harvest.
House of bread, being a town that could barely grow enough of it. That's some biblical irony.
And the Ruth story is actually a perfect case study. Boaz is a wealthy landowner and his workers are harvesting barley. Ruth gleans the barley fields. When she goes home to Naomi, she has an ephah of barley. That's about 22 liters, a substantial quantity. The whole social structure of that story is built around barley as the staple food of ordinary people.
What did that barley bread actually look and taste like? Daniel mentioned trying to make it himself and ending up with these dense, flat, circular loaves. Is that accurate to what we know?
Very much so. Barley has about half the gluten of modern bread wheat. Gluten is what gives dough its elasticity, its ability to trap gas and rise. So pure barley bread doesn't really rise the way wheat bread does. What you get is dense, flat, and, as Daniel noted, intensely satiating. The crumb structure is completely different. It's more like a thick, hearty flatbread than anything we'd recognize as a loaf. Nutty, earthy, slightly sweet, but in a subtle way. Barley has a distinctive flavor profile that's richer than wheat in some respects. If you've ever had barley in a soup or a stew, you know that warm, grounding quality. Now imagine that concentrated in bread form. It's substantial. You eat a piece of barley bread and you know you've eaten something.
The glockenspiel of biblical carbohydrates.
I don't know what that means.
Neither do I, but I'm standing by it. So here's my question. If barley was so central, why did wheat take over? What actually drove the succession?
This is where it gets interesting because it's not one thing. It's a convergence of factors over centuries. The first is purely agricultural. As irrigation technology improved and farming moved into better watered areas, wheat became less risky to grow. The second is economic. Wheat produces a lighter, more versatile flour. It makes better bread by almost any conventional measure. Better rise, better texture, longer shelf life in certain forms.
That's tied to social status.
In the ancient Near East, wheat bread was associated with the wealthy, the priestly class, the royal court. There's a fascinating detail in the temple. The grain offerings could be either wheat or barley, but the showbread, the le companim that sat before the Lord, was specifically made from fine wheat flour. The best flour for the holiest purpose. Barley was for the common people and for animal feed. That status distinction never really went away, it just got amplified as agriculture scaled up.
Wheat becomes the aspirational grain. Barley becomes what you feed the livestock and the peasants.
Eventually, the peasants themselves want to eat wheat because it signals that they've arrived. You can trace this across cultures. In medieval Europe, barley bread was black bread for serfs, wheat was white bread for lords. The linguistic echo of that is still with us. White bread, as a term for something bland and mainstream, is actually a relatively recent reversal. For most of history, white wheat bread was the premium product.
That's a whole separate episode, but I want to zoom back to the biblical period specifically. You mentioned the showbread was wheat. Are there other textual clues about the barley-wheat divide?
The most famous is probably in the Book of Judges. Gideon, before he becomes a great military leader, is threshing wheat in a winepress to hide it from the Midianites. The fact that he's threshing wheat, not barley, tells you something about his family status. They had wheat to hide. Then you have the plague of hail in Exodus. The flax and barley were ruined because they were early crops, but the wheat and spelt were spared because they ripen later. That's an agronomically precise detail embedded in the narrative.
The famous land flowing with milk and honey. Daniel made the point that honey likely meant date honey, Silen. So you got barley bread and date honey. That's the everyday meal.
It's delicious, by the way. I've tried that combination. Barley flatbread with silage drizzled on it. It's genuinely good, nutty, sweet, substantial. You can see why it sustained people.
All right. So we've established barley's dominance, its cultural meaning, the beginnings of the wheat transition. Let's talk about the bread itself, the actual process of making it in the biblical period. What did that look like?
The basic process hasn't changed in its fundamentals for thousands of years, but the details matter. Barley grains would be ground into flour using a quern, essentially a pair of flat stones, one stationary and one rotated by hand. This was daily work, usually women's work, and it was labor-intensive. The flour was coarse compared to modern standards. You'd mix it with water, maybe a pinch of salt if you had it, and then you had a choice, leavened or unleavened.
Most everyday bread was unleavened?
Actually, that's a common misconception. Unleavened bread, matzah, has this enormous symbolic weight in Jewish tradition because of the Exodus story, the haste of departure. But in ordinary daily life, leavened bread was the norm. They'd save a piece of fermented dough from the previous batch, a sourdough starter, essentially, and use it to leaven the new dough. The process was well understood.
The sourdough revival of the last decade is basically just catching up to 3,000 years ago.
As with so many things. The difference is that barley sourdough behaves differently from wheat sourdough. Less rise, denser crumb, tangier flavor. And the baking method, this is important for understanding the texture Daniel described. In the biblical period, bread was typically baked on the interior walls of a tanner, a clay oven. You'd slap the flat dough onto the hot clay surface and it would bake quickly. What you got was something with a slightly charred exterior, a chewy interior, and a shape that followed the curve of the oven wall.
Not a loaf pan in sight.
Not even a concept of a loaf pan. The word loaf itself is a bit misleading. The Hebrew word kikar, which we translate as loaf, literally means something round, a disc. It's describing shape, not structure. These were flat rounds of dense bread, maybe the size of a handspan, that you could tear and share.
This is the bread that shows up in all those metaphors. Breaking bread as an act of fellowship. Bread as the daily provision in the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. That's barley bread in the original context.
It changes how you hear those passages. When Proverbs talks about bread eaten in secret is pleasant, it's not a baguette someone sneaking. It's this dense, sustaining, everyday thing that you'd only bother to hide if you were truly hungry. When the psalmist says, I have been young, and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread. The bread in question is the most basic staple imaginable, the bottom floor of survival.
Let's pick up that thread about wheat supplanting barley. You said it was gradual. When does wheat really win?
It's a long arc. In the biblical period itself, wheat is already the premium grain, but barley still feeds most people. The real shift accelerates in the Roman period. Better agricultural technology, wider trade networks, and the Roman preference for wheat bread. The Romans were wheat snobs of the highest order. By the time you get to the Mishnah, around 200 CE, the rabbis are debating the finer points of wheat versus barley in ritual contexts, but wheat is clearly the default for anything important.
The Roman connection is interesting because the empire basically ran on wheat. Egypt was the breadbasket. The grain dole in Rome was wheat.
And that imperial preference radiates outward. Local elites across the Mediterranean start adopting wheat as their primary grain because it signals connection to Roman culture. Barley becomes increasingly associated with the poor, with rural backwardness, with animal feed. There's a line in the Talmud, I'm paraphrasing, where someone says that barley is fit only for dogs. That's a shocking statement given barley's history, but it reflects how far the status of the grain had fallen by late antiquity.
Yet it never completely disappears.
And this is where Daniel's prompt gets really interesting. He mentioned finding recipes from Scotland and Estonia. Those are exactly the places where barley bread held on. Marginal agricultural zones, cold climates, poor soils. The same conditions that made barley the staple in ancient Israel made it the staple in the Scottish Highlands and the Baltic region.
The Barley Belt, if you want to call it that, is essentially a map of places where wheat couldn't reliably thrive.
That's the heart of it. Barley bread survived wherever the environment dictated it. Scottish Bannocks, Estonian Odra-Karask, Tibetan Sampa, Ethiopian Kolo. These are all barley-based staple foods from regions where wheat was historically unreliable or absent. They're not historical recreations. They're living traditions.
Ah, Bannocks? Those are the Scottish barley flatbreads.
Traditional Scottish bannocks are made from barley flour, or sometimes a mix of barley and oat flour, with water and salt cooked on a griddle. They're dense, hearty, and they were the daily bread of the Highlands for centuries. Very similar in principle to what you'd have eaten in ancient Israel. The griddle replaces the tanner, but the result isn't wildly different.
What about that Estonian one you mentioned?
That's a fascinating one. It's a traditional Estonian barley bread that's essentially barley flour, water, and sometimes a bit of buttermilk, baked as a flat round. It's dense, it's sour, it's incredibly filling. In Estonian folk culture, it was the everyday bread, and wheat bread was for special occasions. Exactly the same status dynamic we see in the Bible. The persistence of that pattern across completely unrelated cultures tells you it's not arbitrary. It's driven by the material reality of the grain itself.
If someone wants to make authentic biblical barley bread today, not a historical reenactment project, but actual edible bread that approximates what people ate, what's the play?
I've got thoughts on this. First, you need the right flour. Daniel mentioned how hard it was to find pure barley flour, and he's right. Most commercial barley bread is a wheat barley blend because barley doesn't perform the way modern consumers expect. You need 100% barley flour finely ground, but not as fine as modern white flour. Health food stores, Middle Eastern grocers, or online specialty millers are your best bet. Barley flour, water, salt, and a sourdough starter if you want it leavened, which is historically accurate for everyday bread. The ratio is roughly 3 parts, barley flour to 1 part water by weight, plus salt to taste. If you're using a starter, add about 20% of the flour weight in starter. Mix it into a dough. It won't feel like wheat dough. It'll be stickier, less elastic, more like a thick paste that you can shape with wet hands.
You're not kneading this the way you'd knead wheat dough.
You can't really. Barley dough doesn't develop gluten structure the same way. You're mostly just making sure everything is evenly distributed. Let it ferment for a few hours if you're using starter. Longer for more sourness, shorter for milder flavor. Then shape it into flat rounds, about the thickness of your finger, and bake it. The traditional method would be on a hot stone or the wall of a clay oven. At home, a pizza stone in a very hot oven, around 450 degrees Fahrenheit, works well. Or a cast iron skillet on the stovetop.
How long are we talking?
Maybe 8 to 10 minutes, flipping once. These are thin flatbreads, not loaves. They'll puff slightly if there's any leavening, but they won't rise dramatically. You're looking for some browning on the surface, a bit of char around the edges. The interior should be cooked through, but still moist. Dense, as Daniel described. Nutty, earthy, with a slight sweetness from the barley and a tang from the fermentation if you went that route. It's best eaten fresh. Barley bread stales faster than wheat bread because of the different starch structure. But fresh off the griddle, with some olive oil and salt, or with silan as Daniel suggested, it's wonderful. It's not a downgrade from wheat bread, it's just a different category of food.
A different category of food. I think that's the key insight here. We assume bread is bread, but barley bread and wheat bread are as different as, I don't know, a banjo and a cello. Same family, completely different register.
The banjo is deeply unfashionable in certain circles, just like barley bread. But it's got history, it's got character, and in the right hands, it's transcendent.
You're a donkey who plays the banjo now.
I'm a donkey who appreciates the banjo.
Of course there are. All right, let me pull on another thread here. You mentioned the status dimension. Barley as poor people. Food, wheat as elite food. How much of the wheat takeover was just economics and agronomy? And how much was that status signaling?
It's impossible to separate them, honestly. The agronomic reality creates the status distinction, and then the status distinction reinforces the economic incentive to grow wheat wherever possible. Once wheat bread becomes the marker of being middle class or above, people will pay a premium for it. Farmers will plant it even in marginal conditions because the market price justifies the risk. It's a feedback loop that's been running for millennia.
It's still running. Gluten-free breads, ancient grain breads, those are status markers now in the opposite direction. Paying extra for what used to be the cheap option.
The gentrification of barley. You can buy a heritage barley loaf at an artisanal bakery in Brooklyn for $12. The same grain that a Judean farmer 3,000 years ago ate because he had no choice.
Vaporwave is basically muzak that's aware of itself as muzak. Barley bread is the ancient grain that's aware of itself as an ancient grain.
But I don't want to be too cynical about it, because there's a genuine rediscovery happening. People are realizing that barley has nutritional properties that refined wheat flour lacks. More fiber, more minerals, lower glycemic index. The dense, satiating quality Daniel described isn't just a curiosity, it's functionally useful. You eat less and stay full longer.
The thing that made it poor people food is now a health food selling point.
The Circle of Life Culinary Edition. But let me add one more layer to this. In the biblical context, there's also a ritual dimension to the barley wheat distinction that we haven't touched yet. The most important ritual involving barley was the Omer offering. Leviticus chapter 23 prescribes that on the second day of Passover, the priest would wave a sheaf, an Omer of the first barley harvest before the Lord. This offering marked the beginning of the grain harvest season and started the countdown to Shavuot, the wheat harvest festival 7 weeks later.
The agricultural calendar itself was structured around the barley to wheat progression.
Barley ripens first in the early spring. Wheat follows about 7 weeks later. The Omer offering of barley is the opening act. Shavuot, with its wheat loaves, is the climax. The ritual calendar literally enacts the transition from the humble grain to the noble one. Barley gets you there first, but wheat is the destination.
That's beautiful, actually. And it mirrors the Exodus narrative. You leave Egypt in haste with unleavened barley bread, and you arrive at Sinai 7 weeks later with the wheat harvest. The journey from slavery to covenant is mapped onto the grain cycle.
I'd never thought of it that way, but you're right. The Omer is barley, Shavuot is wheat. The spiritual journey parallels the agricultural one. It's not an accident. The Torah's ritual calendar is deeply embedded in the agricultural reality of the land. These weren't abstract theological concepts floating in space. They were lived, tasted, smelled, baked.
That brings us back to Daniel's original point. When you read bread in the Bible and you picture a fluffy challah or a sourdough boule, you're missing the sensory world the text is embedded in. You're reading in black and white when the original was in color.
Or reading in wheat when the original was in barley, which is a metaphor I'm going to use forever now.
You're welcome. All right, so let's get practical for a moment. Daniel asked for a recipe recommendation. You've given us the basics. Barley flour, water, salt, maybe a starter, hot surface. But is there a specific recipe you'd point someone to?
There's a recipe I like from an Israeli food historian named Tova Dickstein. She's done extensive work reconstructing biblical era foods, and her barley bread recipe is simple and credible. The proportions are roughly 2 cups of barley flour to 3/4 cup of water, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and if you're leavening it, about 1/4 cup of sourdough starter. Mix, let it ferment for 3 to 4 hours if using starter, Shape into flat rounds, about a half inch thick, and bake on a preheated pizza stone at 450 degrees for about 8 minutes, flipping halfway through.
That's specific. And she's done the archaeological homework?
She's worked with the Israel Museum, she's consulted on historical food reconstructions, and her approach is grounded in both the textual evidence and the material record. The recipe isn't claiming to be exactly what a specific Israelite family ate on a specific day. We can't know that level of detail. But it's in the right ballpark, and it produces something recognizably similar to what the evidence suggests.
For the unleavened version, for those who want the matzah experience?
Same recipe, skip the starter, roll it thinner, maybe a quarter inch, and bake it immediately. What you get is essentially a barley matzah, which is probably closer to what the Exodus narrative describes than the wheat matzah we're familiar with today. The barley matzah would have been darker, denser, more rustic.
More historically plausible.
Wheat matzah requires a level of flour refinement that would have been unusual for a population in flight. Barley matzah is what you make when you're grinding grain in a hurry and baking it on a hot rock. It's the emergency ration version of bread, which is exactly what matzah is supposed to be.
The emergency ration version of bread. That's the show title right there.
I think we already have a show title.
We do, but a donkey can dream. Let me shift gears slightly. We've talked about the biblical period, the wheat transition, the surviving barley bread traditions. What about barley bread today in Israel specifically? Daniel mentioned silin, date honey, which is still widely used. Is there a contemporary Israeli barley bread culture?
It's interesting. Barley bread as a daily staple is not a thing in modern Israel. The default bread is wheat. Pita, challah, the standard loaves. But barley itself is still very present in the culinary landscape. Barley is a key ingredient in cholent, the slow-cooked Sabbath stew. It shows up in soups. And silan, date honey, is having a major revival. It's in every supermarket. It's drizzled on everything. It's the artisanal sweetener of choice.
The ingredients are all still there. They've just been separated from the bread context.
You can walk into any Israeli kitchen and find barley in the pantry and silin in the fridge. Nobody's making barley flatbread as their daily bread. But the components of that ancient meal are still completely familiar. It's not a lost food. It's a scattered food, waiting to be reassembled.
That's essentially what Daniel did. He reassembled it, tracked down the flour, found the recipe, baked it, and had that moment of recognition. Oh, this is what they meant.
Which is a powerful thing. We read ancient texts through a haze of assumptions. Actually tasting the food, holding the dense flatbread in your hand, tearing it, eating it, that's a different kind of understanding. It's embodied. It bypasses the intellectual filters and goes straight to the senses.
There's probably a whole philosophy of biblical interpretation hiding in that observation. But I'll resist the tangent.
I won't resist it entirely. Just to say, the Hebrew Bible is full of sensory language. Taste and see that the Lord is good. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. These aren't just metaphors floating in abstract space. They're grounded in a specific sensory world where bread was dense barley flatbread and honey was dark date syrup. Recovering that sensory world isn't a niche hobby. It's a legitimate mode of understanding the text.
All right, let's talk about the global picture. You mentioned Scotland and Estonia. Where else does barley bread survive as a living tradition?
The barley belt is surprisingly wide. You've got bannocks in Scotland, as we said. Estonia and Latvia have their barley breads, the Estonian karask and the Latvian metu maize. In Finland, there's orarieska, a barley flatbread from the Lapland region. Moving east, Tibet has tsampa, which is roasted barley flour that's mixed with butter tea into a dough, not baked, but functionally the staple carbohydrate. In Ethiopia, barley is still used for kolo, a roasted grain snack, and for various flatbreads in the highlands. In Yemen, barley bread was traditional in the mountainous regions. And in parts of North Africa, barley flatbreads persist in rural areas.
Oh, all marginal environments. Mountains, highlands, deserts, cold northern latitudes.
The pattern is unmistakable. Barley is the grain of the edges. It thrives where wheat fears to tread. And the people in those places developed bread traditions that are sometimes thousands of years old, unbroken. They weren't trying to be authentic to the Bible. They were just eating what their land would give them.
The grain of the edges. That's a good phrase. It also describes barley's cultural position. always at the edge of respectability, always about to be replaced by wheat, and yet never quite disappearing.
There's something resilient about that. Wheat is the grain of empire. Barley is the grain of survival. Empires rise and fall, but the people on the edges keep growing their barley and baking their flatbreads.
That's almost poetic. Are you feeling all right?
I contain multitudes. Corn. Also, I had a good breakfast.
That'll do it. So let's bring this back around to the practical question. If someone listening wants to try this, make authentic barley bread, have that embodied experience of the biblical text, what's the shopping list?
1. Barley flour. 100% barley, not a blend. You may need to go to a specialty store or order online. 4. Optionally, a sourdough starter if you want the leavened, everyday version. 5. A hot surface, pizza stone, cast iron skillet, or even a heavy baking sheet. That's it. The recipe is simple. The technique is forgiving because barley dough doesn't need to be handled delicately. It's not temperamental like wheat dough.
The cooking time is short.
8 to 10 minutes. This is not an all-day project. It's faster than most modern bread recipes because there's no gluten development to wait for. No complex shaping, no second rise. You mix, you rest, if you're fermenting, you shape, you bake. It's bread at its most elemental.
Which is probably why it was the daily bread of the ancient world. Not because they were ascetics who disdained fancy bread. Because it was fast, reliable, and made from a grain that actually grew where they lived.
We tend to romanticize or primitivize ancient food. Oh, they ate simple food because they were closer to the earth. No, they ate barley bread because barley grew in their fields and wheat didn't, and barley bread could be made quickly by people who had 100 other things to do that day. It was practical. The spiritual meanings came later, layered on top of the practical reality.
That's a useful corrective. We read the metaphors and forget the logistics.
The logistics are the soil the metaphors grow in, literally in this case.
All right, one more angle before we wind down. You mentioned the Omer offering and the barley to wheat agricultural calendar. Is there anything else in the biblical text that specifically hinges on barley versus wheat that the modern reader would miss?
There's a fascinating detail in the book of Ezekiel. Chapter 4, God instructs Ezekiel to make bread from a mixture of grains. Wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt, and to bake it using human dung as fuel. It's a prophetic sign act, symbolizing the defilement and desperation of the coming siege of Jerusalem.
That's a rough recipe.
It's intentionally shocking. But notice the grain list, wheat and barley together, plus legumes. That's famine bread. That's what you eat when you can't afford to be picky about your grains. The inclusion of barley alongside wheat isn't a culinary choice, it's a sign of deprivation. In normal times, you'd eat one or the other based on your status. Mixing them means you're scraping the bottom of the storage pit.
Ezekiel's audience would have understood that immediately. They wouldn't have needed a footnote.
The text doesn't explain why the mixed grains are a sign of desperation. It just assumes you know, which is true of so much in the Bible. The sensory and cultural knowledge is assumed, not explained. When that knowledge fades, the text loses dimensions of meaning.
What you're really advocating for is a kind of culinary archaeology as a hermeneutic practice.
I don't know if I'd put it that grandly, but yes. Sometimes the best commentary on a biblical text is a hot griddle and some barley flour. You learn things by doing that you can't learn by reading.
I think that's a good place to land. Barley bread, the grain of the edges, the bread of the Bible, the fastest path to understanding what daily bread actually meant.
Still delicious, if you give it a chance.
Before we close out, I believe we have a visitor.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, a naturalist off the coast of Somaliland documented that the bell of the mauve stinger jellyfish, when struck underwater, resonates at a frequency of approximately 13 hertz. Which is just below the threshold of human hearing, but within the range that induces unease and mild disorientation in submerged divers. The phenomenon was described in a ship's log as the silent bell that makes men seasick without cause.
Jellyfish have a psychological warfare mode. That's unsettling.
The silent bell that makes men seasick without cause is also the name of my next DJ set. To wrap this up, if there's one thing I'd want listeners to take away, it's that the gap between the ancient text and our modern imagination can sometimes be bridged by something as simple as flour and water. You don't need to be a scholar to understand what barley bread meant in the biblical world. You just need to make some.
If you do make some, send us a photo. We'd love to see what you come up with. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, where you can browse the full archive and sign up for updates.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.